Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening, and welcome to this evening's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You can find the Commonwealth Club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org, on Facebook and Twitter, and on our YouTube channel. I'm John Boland, president of KQED Public Media here in San Francisco, and your chair for today's program. This evening's moderator will be Dr. Carrie Curtis, professor emeritus of business at Golden Gate University, and we're both members of the Commonwealth Club board. San Francisco is a thriving, dynamic city, renowned for its beauty, diversity, and creativity, but it's also at the center of the innovation economy and a place where trends start. Tonight, we ask the question, what's next for San Francisco? And to answer this question and discuss the future of the city, we welcome Ed Lee, the 43rd mayor of the city and county of San Francisco. Mr. Lee was appointed on January 11, 2011, by the Board of Supervisors to serve out the remainder of Mayor Gavin Newsom's term after Mr. Newsom resigned to take the office as a Lieutenant Governor of California. Mayor Lee won election to a full term in November 2011. He is the first Chinese-American mayor in San Francisco's history, and he comes to office after a long career in public service, including as city administrator, immediately before being appointed mayor. He has a deep knowledge of how the city works, having previously served as director of public works and worked in executive roles under four previous mayors. Mayor Lee has used innovation and technology to streamline government and to foster a sense of responsiveness, efficiency, and accountability in the city. Please welcome the mayor of San Francisco, Ed Lee.
Thank you, John. It's always good to be back here at the Commonwealth Club, and at least for the first 15 minutes before you throw your questions at me, it'll be good. But I was very thoughtful about this question that you asked, what's next for San Francisco? And I have to be honest with you, my first thought when I heard that question was, well, next? I haven't finished what I started. And I wanted to begin with that because I look around the country, and it's not easy running cities these days. You look at Los Angeles and Chicago and New York as areas where we often compare ourselves to, and you watch very closely, as I've done, and sometimes I get a chance to talk with those mayors, and we're all having our challenges. And they're both local, regional, and national all at the same time. I want to just have that thought for you because I did half serious about what's next for San Francisco because I think what I've been working on are promises that have been made by many mayors for many years that are left unfulfilled. And I've taken my agenda quite seriously with trying to complete enough things so that the city could continue its success. So I'm not ready to actually answer what's next. But I will tell you what's been going on. I've always been, and I will continue to be, a jobs mayor. I've always felt that no matter what you think the issue is, whether it's affordability or the economy, I have always felt comfortable that helping people get jobs, creating jobs, sustaining those jobs in a city like San Francisco is one of the most important things that any mayor can be doing. And I often think that those who argue and debate around what's affordability and where the income gaps are, and those will be topics I'm sure you'll mention today, I think the biggest gap will always be between a person that has a job and a person who doesn't have a job. So I want to cover everybody's willingness to have that job. People have come from all over the world trying to seek a better life, and they deserve an opportunity to hit all the jobs that we can create and that reflect our strong economy. I will never forget, as long as I live, those double-digit unemployment years where we were cutting budgets and we couldn't look each other in the eye and without saying, what else are we going to have to leave behind? Who else are going to we're going to have to cut out of the budget? What else we cannot do? And as I look forward today, I think that horizon is changing very fast. You already know what those unemployment rate numbers have been. You've read about them. We're averaging about 5.2% at the moment. When I began, it was 9.6%. And that means over 40,000 people got some new jobs in the city, and there's more to come. In creating those jobs, I also wanted to make sure that they covered a wide spectrum. Yes, the conversation is about technology, but guess what? When we lowered the unemployment rate, it was across all sectors. All sectors are very hot by way of employment these days. I will point to the healthcare, to tourism, as well as technology. We're picking up on all the hospitality that we can get, and we're competing very, very well. And that's why in creating jobs, I wanted to make sure that our economic development and workforce training programs matched those strong industries. So in reaching out and making sure that people need to get trained and needed to have the ability to get in these jobs, we focused our career academies on construction, on healthcare, green jobs, hospitality, tech jobs. And just this last year, we were able to place over 1,000 low-income individuals across all these sectors after they were properly trained in our career paths. Well, key to jobs these days is skill sets. And so, of course, I focused on education as a result of that. If you look at all the technology companies, in fact, all the companies that are hiring these days, they're asking a lot about education background and skill sets. And many of them are seeing whether or not they can double or triple up on individuals. In other words, get twice as much out of you. And that's what my daughters have always told me when they're looking for jobs. They want more out of me than just my single degree. And so skill sets have become very important, and that's why I have focused on education from the very early to all the way through what we have to do with City College. And education, for me, has been a matter this past year about trying to focus on where I can make the biggest difference. And I came to a conclusion early last year that given all the data that I had been studying with our public schools, middle schools was where we were most challenged. That is where all the truancy started. That is where parents became higher numbers of disengagement with their kids happened. That is where the performance of our schools became worse amongst all the standards and the tests and so forth. And after studying that, I felt I needed to do something about it. So I personally adopted the middle schools last year. And after a brief, small grant from Corrett Foundation and a few friends to show them what we could do with adopting one of the middle schools and wiring them up, Wi-Fiing them up, giving the kids access to iPads and training some of the teachers, I was able to convince Mr. Benioff to put in $3.7 million of investment to the middle schools along with our idea of coalescing with all the principals. And we got there's 20 middle schools in the city, but we focused on the 12 middle schools that were all peer middle schools. And by the summer of last year, we wired them all up. We provided them with iPad carts, and this is the first year they're operating. And perhaps we'll follow up with a video one of these days where you'll see these kids playing with the new technology, but they're learning the skill sets that they will need in the 21st century. And we have rolled out this program in a way in which it's going to transform the entire public school system, beginning with the middle schools. We are re-upping our children's fund this year in November for a 10-year engagement. It's been 10 years since we looked at or since we started funding school and education enrichment for our children. And we are now revisiting all the things that we thought 10 years ago, what has worked and what has not worked. And we are going to be putting before the voters a plan to reinvest in our children, not just education, but all the enrichment programs before and after school as well. Throughout this time, I've had a great conversation with a number of people, including Mr. Benioff and many of the established philanthropists of the city, Charles Schwab, the Fisher family, the Goldmans, the Hellmans and others, Shorenstein, and they've all been very guiding to me about what we can do to entice a new philanthropy in the city as we celebrate Levi's and Wells and Schwab and all of what they are doing currently and what they have done in the past. And I'm excited, quite frankly, about the philanthropy in this city because I know that the people who have been successful will oftentimes recognize why they've been successful and point back to the beauty of the city and all that they have enjoyed and will join me in my very strong suggestion to them that they give back, as Benioff and Ron Conway have now really led the charge with many other philanthropists to say that we can build another generation of philanthropy. And we're seeing that already happen. We're seeing the dialogue that has to occur. We're seeing the successes. And it isn't just a $6.5 or $6.8 million Google contribution to Muni. It is also the Benioffs to the hospitals. It's Jeremy Stoppelman at Yelp. It's Daniel Lurie with his collaboration with some 20 different companies now building a $10 to $20 million fund, and it still involves Google in all of these aspects. I think by the end of this, and I think it's going to go on, but I always suggested that if we have 2,000 tech companies in the city, we ought to have 2,000 foundations helping us do a lot of different things to bridge the gaps. I'm involved in housing, as I indicated in my State of the City address. Some of our crises has been in the works for decades, and I don't believe we built enough housing in the city, housing for all different incomes. And so pushing forward a aggressive 30,000 housing units by 2020 is not, in my opinion, a new. It should have been done a while back. But we did that housing trust fund to create $1.5 billion in the next 30 years. That was just the money part. I think building of the housing is where we need to get the implementing of that building and finding the sites, and particularly those sites that are publicly controlled. We can bring the cost down of housing rapidly if we control those public sites. We are doing so with City College, with the school district, with our own PUC and the entities in the administration that own land. Always, always paying attention to infrastructure. And whether it's the five hospitals that are under seismic construction now that are producing thousands of jobs, will be ready in case there's a big event, or helping serve the new economy and all the people that need better health care, those hospitals are extremely important to us. As important as expanding Moscone, our airport that continues to improve itself, or small arts venues like the Bayview Opera House we just announced the other day, or Mr. Schwab's contribution in raising over $500 million to expand and improve SF MoMA, the Mexican Museum, all the things that we're doing on infrastructure, we are paying attention to that and building those as we speak. I am also a mayor that's always been about strong neighborhoods, because that, to me, is what San Francisco has always been about. All the attention is not on downtown, by the way, even though media has a lot of that attention. But we have been more than quiet, going to Terraval and to Outer Mission and to Excelsior and Clement and Outer Richmond, Geary Boulevard, and all the other corridors with our Invest in Neighborhoods, because I do believe that when we are challenged with big natural disaster events, it will be the strength of our neighborhoods that really save us. And so investing in them now, making sure they know that We have not only emergency plans that include them, but we're investing in small businesses, making their corridors vital, vibrant, making it more walkable and safe, including all the pedestrian challenges that we have. We're touching those as well. And that leads me to, finally, our transportation challenges in the city, with which we've been working on as vigorously as our housing. We put out together a 2030 transportation vision where we'll have to spend up to over $10 billion if we're going to have all the different modes of transportation that get people in, out, around, and through our city. And it isn't just muni buses. It includes them. It includes fleets. But it also designing our streets properly, making sure they're pedestrian safer, making sure people with disabilities can get through them and use them properly, inviting people to walk more and making those streets safer. As you know, we've had a bit of hard time with pedestrian fatalities. Unacceptable, totally. You have my commitment that we will do what we can now, and that's why we have certain hotspots throughout our neighborhoods where we're parking officers and citing for people who refuse to yield or speeding or running red lights. Until we get those streets redesigned or lit it up properly or the right signage or the other design things that our experts will tell us we should be doing in order to slow and make safer our streets. We will ask you, the public, in the spirit of a partnership to join us this November and approve a $500 million general obligation bond to fund all these transportation parts, as well as an increase in the vehicle license fee to pay for pavements improvement in our streets in our city. And in doing so, and in making that announcement, I challenged our muni and suggested to them that if I'm going to be talking to audience like you tonight and to many that I have in the past couple months about this general obligation bond for transportation, that we ought to get off of nickel and diming everybody with Sunday meter citations. You know, almost half of those half of that money made on Sundays is through the hurt that people have to pay with citations. And I needed some confirmation, so I'm going to ask you tonight to let me know that if we get rid of those parking meter enforcements on Sunday, will that help us in the overall conversation about investing in our transportation system in November? Because some of the people are debating with me saying, that's one different thing or the other. And I'm saying, I've got to have more conversations with people in this city about being more helpful to families and the people want to get around, rather than trying to nickel and dime them on Sundays, where I think people ought to be a little bit more relieved from the busyness of Monday through Saturday. So will you let me know if there's a direct connection there? Thank you. I didn't want to go on too long. I know the biggest purpose tonight is to listen to your questions. Be easy with me. I'm just, you know. But I take my job seriously. I love this city. I've always felt that this is a chance to prove how much I love the city. And with all of the stuff that is happening, and whether it's the affordability, whether it's protests and so forth, my job still is to unite the city in the highest way we can, to keep focused on people, on their hopes and dreams of the city, why they came to the city in the first place, to celebrate the diversity that we have, to build international markets for our businesses, as well as an appreciation of the public-private partnerships that we have to have, and to have a constant way of suggesting to people, you get more out of convincing us in a civil way than you do out of protesting your way to change. This is what I'm all about. I am very happy to serve the city. I will continue working as hard as I can, and I know you're about to remind me of the things I haven't done yet. Thank you very much.
It's now time to begin the audience question period. My name is Kerry Curtis. I'm on the board of governors of the Commonwealth Club. And it's a privilege to be here with you, Mary Lee. The question I've been wanting to ask you for a while now is that you, I've observed you in your office, and you seem to always be smiling and in a good mood. So my question is, are you really having fun, or is that just an act?
You know, I try to find the best in people. You know, some of the folks I've known for many, many years have had harsh lives or things that have occurred and happened in their life. And I've been through that myself. I mean, I've always felt that if I'm in a public setting and I represent the city of San Francisco, I should always be welcoming of different opinions, of harsh views, of things that I have yet to be made aware of. So I think a smile and a presentation of yourself as being inviting for conversation and for engagement ought to be what I should do both professionally and personally. And I think my wife likes me that way better.
Well, a smile goes a long way, that's for sure. And getting ready for this event, I was reading up on your, you know, your bio and your history and so forth. And I was trying to get my own mind around your personal journey. Mm-hmm. So you grew up, your parents were Chinese immigrants.
Yes.
You grew up in Seattle. And then you went to, is it Bowdoin College?
Yes, Brunswick, Maine.
And wound up with a summa cum laude record there. So I'm trying to visualize this Chinese guy from Seattle winding up at this, what I assume to be an upper middle class white enclave in Maine. What was that like?
Well, it was academically the most enthralling thing I could have done. I got convinced by a high school history teacher who befriended me after my father died in high school that I would not ever be happy in a large university, that I would personally be more gratified with engaging professors on a more personal level. And he had told me about these liberal arts colleges on the East Coast where the professors would have dinner with you, they would spend hours talking with you, and they would oftentimes ask you a question that you would never be asked. And I thought, well, what was that question? Well, the question they really would ask you is, what do you really want to do? And that's what happened at Bowdoin. I joke around a lot because you're right. I came from a pretty urban setting. So we were a third Caucasian, a third Asian, a third African-American in Seattle. So I was pretty urban, played basketball, kind of had some little tough street smarts. And coming to a liberal arts college in the East Coast, I had to kind of evolve the way in which I talked to people. But I was a jokester. I kind of had fun in life. So people knew I came from Seattle, but they would say, because I was one of five Asians on the campus, and they would say, well, how did you get into this school? And I didn't know how to take that, you know, sometimes. So I said, well, what do you mean? He says, well, my father was, you know, this, and they went to Princeton, Yale. I went, oh, okay, I don't have that background. So I said, well, yeah, I'm famous too. So I said, hey, we're from Seattle. Says, yeah, my brother's Bruce. And I went around the campus joking around, and everyone said, that's Bruce Lee's brother. You know, I was pretty athletic at the time. So I had my way of joking.
Bruce Lee, in other words. Yeah.
But I loved the academic. I loved the fact that there were never a class more than 15 people, that you were asked, what do you really want to do? I can dive into religious studies and philosophy and history and political science as well as math and others, and you would have all the attention you need. These are the advantages of quality schools across the country. And I enjoyed it so much, Gary, that I stayed all 3 out of the 4 summers. I stayed there. I didn't go back home to Seattle. I stayed there. I worked in the Upward Bound program. And I joked around because it's been 40 years since I graduated from Bowdoin. I'd never gone back in those 40 years. And they're inviting me back to a 40th reunion.
And some of the professors asked me, how come you didn't come back? And I have to be honest. I said, well, you taught me so well. You remember that old television series Kung Fu where the Shaolin priest was at the school and he finally got all the teachings of his priests and then he went out to change the world. I kind of felt that way about Bowdoin, that they had taught me so well, allowed me to appreciate how to learn on my own, that I didn't feel the necessity of having to go back, but I wanted to go out and change the world. So, but they're going to invite me back for a 40-year reunion. I'm going to take them up on it and in this status and see what the campus has evolved in.
So. It sounds like it's going to be a nice homecoming.
Yeah.
You came out of Bowdoin College with such a stellar record, and you decided to go to Cal for your law degree rather than Stanford. So thank you for that. I'm a Cal guy. Go Bears.
All right, go Bears.
But then you had another transition. So after your law degree, you went into public advocacy and those kinds of things. You wound up in city government in a variety of administrative and appointed kinds of positions. But then lightning struck, and you went from an appointed position into the hard glare of the very political job as mayor. And so I was just sort of wondering what that transition must have been like for you, yeah, going from just a regular job. I'm not sure that being a city administrator is a regular job. But going into this very political environment, was that a personal challenge to you?
Absolutely. You know, I spent 21 years in under four mayors in five different departments. So I've been in. I first started in Mayor Agnos's administration as the chief whistleblower investigator. So he wanted to use my investigative skills to conduct investigations on anything in the city that was improper government activities or illegal. That's awfully powerful for someone who's never worked in government before to be invited to do that. I made a lot of friends very quickly because I got to investigate anything, but I was very respectful of people, and I usually, if I identified something that was improper or illegal, I didn't like go to the media. I said, here's an opportunity for you to correct it. It's a practice that's going on, whether it's discrimination or improper use of contracts or things like that. You're going to have to take care of it. But by the way, I got a record of it. And at some point in time, someone's going to ask me what I investigated. So either you take care of it or this becomes the record. And the city attorney's office at the time was very complimentary, taught me a lot of things about how to get along. And I suspect that's why I'm mayor now, because I have all the closets in my, all the skeletons in the closet. I went from there to Human Rights Commission director to continue the advocacy, but from within. And then when Willie Brown became mayor, he appointed me to purchasing. Now, I asked for that job. And here's a little story that I think some of you might understand. This is back in the early 90s, and I had been struggling with, you know, I've been advocating how women and minorities and other disadvantaged individuals can get equality and do better. And I really felt that the city could do better. So I asked for this job because it allowed me to learn the real business of the city, because I had come to the conclusion that civil rights, I was only playing in the margins as an advocate, as a legal advocate. The real civil rights was economic justice. And I came to that conclusion, and I asked Willie, could I get, if I conduct myself properly, can I get a job that really is in the center and the heart of business? And boy, did he put me at the center heart of business. Because every year, the purchaser is in charge of spending $1 billion of your dollars to buy everything from cars to computers to services to construction work. And in understanding that business, and who we do business with and how we do business with, I came into the crux of the way the city is run. And I learned a lot. I honored all of the procurement things, but I also changed the procurement process so that we can work a lot more with local businesses. And that was one of the big thrusts, policy thrusts by the board and the mayor at the time is, we spend this money, but it's all going out to these international companies. Why don't we build our own little bit of our own local economy? So I did that, and that was the purpose, and we did a lot of great things there. So I thought I was having fun, and then Willie gave me the hardest job I have in my life, and that he appointed me to the public works director spot. And it was the hardest, but I learned the most. I had to pick up people's garbage. I had to clean all the alleyways. I had to pick up cigarette butts along parks. But I used those opportunities to learn what people who were doing this every single day were thinking about. So that was where I really learned about my labor relations, about the greediness of the city, about all the demands that have been unmet. Public works is at the center of everybody's demands, and it still is. But I was able to learn a lot of good things about everything from labor to how the city services. So I went from business to servicing residents and neighborhoods. And I took opportunities like when the doggy diner head fell down one night, you know, and I brought it back to DPW and we fixed it all. Now you go back out there at Sloat and you'll see the most beautiful doggy diner head. And I take pride in that because it was done by city workers. So one, you kind of keep that relationship going. But you honor the past. You honor our great history of the city. And you give people an artistic, iconic thing to see. And every Valentine's Day, I have the elementary kids come with me. And we bring the dogs out from Animal Care and Control. And we celebrate and have Valentine's lunch at the Doggy Diner ahead on Sloat Street. So if you ever want to see me out there, come out on February 14th. And then Gavin came in. I became city administrator. I asked him, throw at me everything that is problematic, that you're going to be announcing a lot of things. I got kind of used to him announcing what's next. That's my kind of little joke, because he's always about what's next. And I was about, well, okay, let me finish this first. Then you can ask. So give it to me so I can actually implement it and do it. And so I asked for things like the electric vehicles and things like that. All of that good administration, I learned a lot. And then this calling of being the mayor, there's stories that probably will take a long time to explain, but Senator Feinstein and the Giants have everything to do with my saying yes to being mayor of San Francisco, and one of these days we'll tell you more about that. But what I have to be honest with you, I don't like fundraising. I don't like asking people for money. I try to figure things out, but that's part of fundraising in the political climate these days. And I have no problem asking money from companies to do something for the city. That's very different. And I will enjoy those philanthropic efforts that are going on, because to me that's the public-private partnerships that we have. But the political campaigning is not for me.
Yeah. How do you feel about being asked for money?
Well, I kind of got used to that with two daughters.
I remember when I was raising two daughters that I would before ATMs even, I would load up my wallet with a bunch of 20s. And then during the weekend, they would just go flying out.
Well, I mean, the budgets are all about people making demands on the resources that we have. And one of the things that I've been working very hard on, and I think hopefully that you've seen it, is that we put a lot more fiscal discipline into our budgets. We have two-year budget planning. We have five-year financial planning. We have all the credit ratings up higher than the history of the city. I have three different financial reserves in the city. Of course, you know, some people want me to deplete some of those reserves, but we're in the strongest credit foundation we've ever been in, because you just don't know what's going to happen around the corner. You know, people say there's a bubble, there could be things that occur, we could have, you know, a disaster. I just want the city to be really strong so that when we take on things, we have some fiscal discipline to do it. We complete what we promise. That's why I honor all these general obligation bonds. You'll always see me. We got to finish the old ones before we promise new ones. Because I don't want to be increasing people's property taxes.
Back in the 70s, I was working for Bank of America. Yes, I really am that old. And at that time, there was a lot of anger and dissatisfaction in the business community about the city and county of San Francisco. They were beating the drums about charter reform, financial irresponsibility, and so forth. Now, maybe I'm just not paying attention, but it seems like that drumbeat and the dissatisfaction from the business community is a lot less today. Is that your impression?
It's a lot less depending upon what issue you're dealing with. But yes, I do think so. I think that when you have an administration that is job-friendly, job-creation-friendly, job-sustaining-friendly, you're going to have mediums to talk with business. But you're also going to have mediums to talk with a lot of people. People want jobs. They want sustained, good jobs. They want better-paying jobs. And our new economy is demanding that. And I can't think of a way better than to work with business, with technology leaders, with healthcare leaders, with tourism leaders to promote all of that. And that's why it's so important for me to get these. Now it's 7,000. Last year we did 6,800 summer jobs with kids. All of them were paying jobs, no free internships. Everybody got paid, and we're trying to instill in all of our youth, focused on some of the most disadvantaged, troubled youth, getting them to earn their way forward. And if we continue doing that, I think there's a correlation between that and reducing, yet again, homicides by a third, as we did last year, and a third the previous year. There is a correlation of reaching to get these young kids, getting them something they can earn, and making sure they're on the path, and then trying to lower the homicide and violence in the city.
Right. Well, as I'm going through these questions from the audience, there are a great many of them. And they tend to fall into some categories, the biggest of which is the tension between the tech community and the jobs, gentrification on the one hand, and housing, squeezing out lower-income people, Ellis Act issues, and stuff like that. So my first question is, does that amount to a culture war or not? And how do you balance those two legitimate concerns, jobs, economic growth on the one hand, and protecting the rights of lower-income people?
Well, if we comfort ourselves with just blaming and describing what the problem is, it will be a culture war if we don't find solutions. And so, I went to Bowdoin College, so I ought to be able to understand what people are saying and then translate that into some solutions. And that's why we came out with a pretty comprehensive set of solutions for what we call the affordability challenge, affordability gap. I have to say, I understood what those protests are at Google buses and so forth, but it didn't make a little sense to me, because all people were doing was trying to get to work. They weren't trying to get into a bunch of individual cars to go down to Palo Alto, just trying to get to work. So why would you protest that particular activity? So we try to articulate, what is it that you really are having a problem with? And the problem is the income gaps that are going on, that the technology workers seem to be more successful than the artists and nonprofits that are feeling the squeeze in affordable housing. Okay, then let's try to solve it. And so there's a 7-point plan that we put together that hits at all these areas. One, let's stop these speculative evictions that are going on in the city. I think we got a lot of people to agree that if someone comes in and all they want to do is flip your building and evict all the tenants out and make some money and then leave the town, that's not part of our economy. I love landlords who want to be responsible landlords. But I don't like speculators to come in. So why don't we just plug that loophole? Stop that. Senator Mark Leno is making every good attempt to do that. It's called Ellis Act eviction, and he's having a loophole plugging there, and that's the first of seven. Then we got to preserve our affordable housing stock, and that means that we look at all the different planning and what people are trying to do in developments in their buildings and ask, are you depleting the housing stock or are you maintaining the housing stock? And we, of course, favor those developments that will not deplete our affordable housing stock. So that's how you kind of do the stabilization part. Then you got to get into and then prevent evictions, prevent some of that hurt. Then you got to go into an agenda about how to start building. And I got that goal of 30,000. I think we can get there. That's 6,000 units of housing each year. We have the ability to do that if we identify all the land that we have. In fact, thousands of units are already being built. The scenario is being fulfilled if you look at what's happening in the southeast sector of our city, particularly the shipyards, areas that we had planned for. Those investments are already turning the corner. Hundreds are being built, but I need to turn them into thousands. So we're accelerating the permits for housing, and particularly for affordable housing. The 30,000, I want to make sure at least a third of that is permanently affordable. So we're creating ways in which that affordability can be met with the creation of things like down payment assistance programs, buying down the cost of land. One of the ideas we have that is beginning to get traction from some of the corporations is land investment bank, if you will, to actually get a hold of land, buy it, and then long enough so that we could get the other investment to build housing on it. But we have to land bank some of this land. If we don't, then the market is going to dictate, and that's going to be why the cost of housing is so much.
It's going to be market rate, high-cost housing.
That's right. And the developers are helping me think through all of this. The best developers in the city, they're putting up all the high-rises downtown and south of Market. They're in the room with me and housing advocates talking through these ideas and how to fast-track things that could make things more affordable.
Well, I'm glad to hear that you don't think that talking to business people is against your democratic principles.
I think they are critical to getting these democratic principles
done.
I'm a
professor of business, so I had to say that. Well, there's an early feedback about your question about Sunday parking meters. So there's one vote for yes. Please remove the Sunday meters. We do wish to have a visitor as well as resident-friendly city. So there's one vote.
All right.
How about the Central Subway project? Is the political, it hasn't finished building yet, but is the political process over with, or is there more to come on that issue?
I'd love to say that the political challenges of the Central Subway are over, but, you know, there's always somebody waiting for some kind of a lawsuit effort to stop it. But, by the way, the two boring machines are in the ground. One of them is already past the Stockton Street Tunnel, and the other is just behind it. So the boring is on time, on budget, and where we will take them out at the old Pagoda Theater in North Beach, that's all been cleared. And so things are getting ready to be completed. And the operational time is 2019. Having said that, and that takes, it's a while, but all the things that are done, there's been no big, you know, the reason why I say that is because the significant tunneling was under BART. And it's already past that without any major problems or disruptions. So now I can say the tunneling that is going to get completely done. There was a time of about a month or two that we all, every day I was coming in, any challenges, any vibrations, any other things? And they cleared the BART tunnels. That's a good sign. The other positive note is that the people in North Beach are now saying, starting the conversation about extending it all the way to Fisherman's Wharf. And I think we have to at least study it But the best compliment we ever got was, let's bring it all the way down because it makes sense. Well, these are the same people that fought us on having the central subway in the first place. But I do believe, and I truly believe this, mark my words, if you're all in the same room with me in 2019, when you ride that central subway, you're going to say, gosh, this was a great idea, because the streets will be crowded. The tunnels will be smooth underground. They'll get people up and down, north and south, very efficiently.
One of the recurring themes in all these questions, there's two things. One is this gentrification and so forth, the tension with that in housing and so forth. Another one is, are we making too many concessions to corporations, tax breaks to get them to stay in San Francisco, the Twitter deal and so forth? So one of the questions, and I don't have it at my fingertips because there are so many here, but says that the research suggests that maybe the tax incentives to businesses to locate in a particular location generally don't yield the return in jobs that they're supposed to. So what's your take on Twitter and the other efforts that the city has made to persuade companies to stay here or to locate here?
Well, I think the first big piece of data is your unemployment, numbers drop dramatically. They were as low as 4.8% just a month ago. They got revised up to 5.1%. So on a citywide basis, I believe that the attraction of the technology companies and the businesses that came in to mid-market contributed to that lowering of unemployment. The other is, those of you who have walked the same walk that I've walked for many years along Market Street, if you don't see the difference, you're not looking at all. There's a huge difference in the way it feels. And not just there, I think it sparked the whole thing from Castro all the way down. All of that now is hot real estate. People are setting up businesses. There's housing being built. Some 3,000 units on Market Street alone is going to open up within months. 3,000 units. And they're all almost finished. And you can literally count them. The NEMA project, the Trinity Plaza, and the AVA one on 9th. And the businesses that are already locating there is transforming all the storefronts. Where when I started, a third of all storefronts on every block of Market between 10th and 5th were vacant. One third were vacant. You can hardly find a vacancy right now. There are some, but they're in negotiations with us. And developers that we've known for years, Shorenstein and others, they're there now talking about buildings that are on the side, like the Hollywood Billiards and that property down there. Very challenged, very ugly. Looks like it would, that came out of the Mission Bay fire. It looked that horrible. That all that's going to be under new development. So you got investor confidence. And it was because I think we signaled that we wanted to work with business and we wanted to invite them to stay. I truly believe Twitter would have gone to South San Francisco had we not made that. But I also think that we would not have enticed the other now 15 companies that are taking advantage of the tax incentive. It is a six-year payroll tax exemption. That we offered to them if they located only in that corridor. So if someone were to tell you it's a big citywide tax break, that's not true. It's only if they located in that corridor, and only those companies would benefit from it. Well, those companies have grown tremendously in the hundreds of employment. And what we're trying to do is target the employment now to local residents and do all the kinds of things that we need to do to get them to do local procurement, help with the nonprofits around the area, improve the area. But I suggest to you that it's changed dramatically for the positive.
I see that myself when I walk down Market Street. to do a segue from the jobs and the tension between jobs and lower income people and so forth to homeless, which is the other big category of questions here. On the mid-market area, when that process of upgrading mid-market is completed, where are the homeless people going to go? You're not going to make them not homeless. They're going to have to go somewhere else. So what's the situation with homeless in San Francisco? And is there anything in the works to change that trend?
Well, recent articles, and I think many of you probably have read them, suggest that the challenge continues to be a big challenge. And I'll be very candid with you. I gave myself a C last year because I didn't think we were doing enough. Not so much in the broad sense. I appreciate what our Department of Human Services and Bevin through the HOPE program and public health have done, because they literally have done a tremendous job. We did get 10,000 people homes that didn't have before. What we probably didn't anticipate was that those ranks would be filled by others. And our city is very attractive. It's not just the technology people coming. Everybody's coming with a hope of a future, and they may or may not get it. And so you'll find teachers and small business owners and others in those homeless ranks. What I am disappointed in, and I've challenged myself to do better, and we will, is the focus on the 200 to 300 who keep coming through the doors of mental issues, but they self-medicate through drugs. And they are repeaters and repeaters in our public health system on an emergency basis. There's about 200 or 300 of them. I don't think we did enough to really try to cure those individuals, because they're costing you and me some tremendous dollars and huge pressure on our health system. Some people call it the Lohr's Law. We need to work with medical professionals to offer a more humane conservatorship experience for them to sustain a change in their physical and mental situation. And I call it more care, not less care. And so that's what I'm going to do, and I'm already, there's a number of meetings I'm having with all the different entities that are involved in this. And it's the judges, it's the DA, it's the public defender, it's our mental health division of our public health department, all in an effort to have medical professionals have a lot more say in these court situations with the judges about whether or not someone's been really cured, or whether he or she just looks nice for 1 or 2 days and will go right back to the habits, and they will be coming back and we'll repeat ourselves. We just haven't done enough. I want to make an effort there, because I think we'll all appreciate that. And they're the ones that I think are the ones that are constantly, we know them by their names, and we know where they are, and we'll clean up the library, and they'll move to the United Nations, and they'll move into the alleyways, and we'll see the same people. I got to help them. I got to help them more.
Some of those people don't really want to be taken off the streets. I am talking like I know what I'm talking about, but what I've read is that you offer them space and shelters, and then they don't want that. They want to be back on the street. Is that a correct perception?
There are some individuals of that, but there are also those same individuals are not very stable in their lives. They've got many of them are on, I think, a lot of drug abuse, and they find it a little easier to exist on the streets with the cash that sometimes they get. They'll get a hit, $5 here, $10 there, and that'll sustain them for a couple of days. I think those are the people that are going to die in our streets. We have an opportunity to prevent that.
So, several questions from the audience have to do with that, related questions. So this one is there a plan to revitalize the Tenderloin area? And then there's a question about the Civic Center Plaza, cleaning that up, again, the homeless people. And then there's a question about the removal of bus shelters because of a lot of drug activity going on there. That turns out then to be an inconvenience for the public and for disabled people and so forth. So there's all these questions from the audience about ripple effects of the homeless. You can solve the problem in one area, as you said, and then the problem, which is people with difficulties, goes to another area. Is there any silver lining anywhere in there?
I continue to be a very true believer that the solution to homelessness is housing with supportive services. That is part of the overall housing agenda. It is more expensive to place on-site services and housing. We do have programs for that to happen, and we're going to increase our efforts to do that. But I want to make sure our city is safe. And I don't necessarily connect homelessness with the city being unsafe. I think there are a lot of people who will behave themselves whether or not they're homeless or on the streets. But there are areas of the city where we've had to clean up, and we will continue doing that, and the main library is one of them. That wasn't a purpose, was for those activities that we all have read about that we feel disgusted on, that should never have happened. And so I promised everybody from Senator Feinstein and others that we're going to clean it up and make the library welcome, because we're about to establish a new media teen center at the main library. We can't have families and kids with all that negative activity and bad behavior. So we got to set the standards of behavior on the streets. The police, public health, others are going to help me make sure that standard is one that's respective but also safe for everybody. And so these actions that might be everything from abusing property to threatening people, that's all got to change, and we'll take sections by sections to do that.
A related issue that keeps coming up in these questions is has to do with transportation and providing more convenient transportation. I want to read one verbatim, and I hope the person is here. I am a kid in middle school, and I take the car almost every day. Hopefully he doesn't drive it himself. The school bus doesn't reach my neighborhood, so can there be more school buses? Did the person who asked this question in the audience? Oh, I was hoping that. Oh, there we are, over there.
Thank you.
So, do you have any influence on school buses?
It's a state. I mean, the school buses were a state-funded operation. When they decided not to fund it, the city couldn't pick up the tab at the time. This was a number of years ago, which is why that whole effort to have free muni for youth came about, was because of the pressures of not having those school buses. Is that the answer? No, not sure that's the answer yet. But we are getting traction more and more about whether it's muni or, maybe lack of a better word, I think the MTA has to help the school district deal with the lack of buses and how to get kids in and across. It could very well be, and I've seen this in other countries, some limited shuttle services. And that might be an answer. It might be also something that we can create on a pilot basis with some philanthropic efforts there. Just as they've done with helping us with free muni. One of my priorities is to help seniors in the city get around better. I'm going to see if we can lower the cost of muni for seniors by getting some philanthropic hands involved in that as well.
Right. You were a supporter of, was it called the 8 Washington Project, which was voted down. And now we have the prospect of the Warriors development out on Pier 3032.
Has your thinking evolved on that? Is that a good place for the Warriors, or should it be somewhere else in the city?
Mm-hmm. Well, I have felt that Pier 3032 has had historic challenges, and you know, this is the third attempt. These 16 acres of land out there is falling into the water, literally. It would cost us $100 million ourselves to repair those piers, or $40 million to take it down without environmental consequences. Port doesn't have the money. We don't have the money for that. So you have a sports franchise, the Warriors, who say they'll pay for the whole thing out of their own pocket. And right now their engineering costs are as high as $180 million just to seismically fix the piers, without anything on top of it.
Wow.
And it's a $1 billion project to put a stadium and all the other things that they have shown they may be willing to do on that pier. I've always suggested that such a development would probably have to be reviewed by the voters so that it would prevent them from having litigation endlessly. I have supported that site and their ability to develop across the street. And I think the waterfront ballot proposition, all it suggests is if you go beyond the current height limits, you have to go to the voters to do so. And it's somewhat consistent with what I've been believing that the Warriors have to do. They've got to win this with the voters as well. But I do think that they have it's all private money. They truly believe in the success of this pavilion and all it has to offer. And I've been very supportive of that idea, and we can work on all the transportation issues that are there in a positive way. But I'll say if we don't do that, we will have lost a great opportunity. They're in the environmental impact review process as we speak. That's a complicated process, and they are required by law to study other sites, and that's what they're doing. They're giving other sites a real effort. The attraction to 3032, though, is the biggest attraction. It is the closest proximity to the BART station. So you can literally walk 2.5 blocks to get there. And therefore, that is the big selling point for them.
For the Embarcadero station?
Yes, because the other sites that they are required to study, and they are studying that, will attract more car use.
And I know you're aware that the Commonwealth Club is building a new home on the Embarcadero at 110 the Embarcadero.
I've been informed of that.
I know you've, Charlotte Schultz has been adamant that you're supposed to be helpful in that regard.
And I will be.
We may be neighbors to the Warriors when we finally. It's going to take them a lot longer to get their building built than us. So we have time for one more question. And you worked for four different mayors, until you were mayor yourself. So the question is, which one was your favorite one?
Oh no!
And I want to ask you which one was the worst. But answer that however you want.
I enjoyed each mayor. They're all different.
Oh, come on.
No. It's different now that I'm mayor, because I can literally understand some of the situations in which each of the mayors acted. I never understood why they weren't consistently all good on every day. Now I know why. Because I certainly am not, for very good reason. But I have to say that the mayors of San Francisco, I appreciate them even more. And it's really funny, because I do this little game of mine every morning. I walk in the hallway. If you've ever been in room 200 and you walk into the mayor's office, there's a picture of every single mayor. And all I say with a little kidding, as I look up, as I pass from Gavin to the next one, I said, shut up, I'm going to work. Because they're all laughing that this is your turn, and they've gone through it all, and I know what it means now. And it's sacrifice. It is really having to show how much you love the city and all of its people, every neighborhood. You can't let down your concern for any one neighborhood. And you got to try to do your best with all the different issues. And some people think I've got an easy time because it looks from the outside that we're doing pretty successfully. They have no idea. Success means more issues and more challenges in the city. It never lets up. But then again, you turn around and you go, God, that Bad Kid Day was so good. The World Series was so fun. The America's Cup, how could we have done that? The 49ers, I mean, you look at these major events, things that we host, the conventions, it's all worth it. It's worth all the pain and the... I mean, there's been times when you're literally almost in tears. You know, when you got firefighters that die, or a police officer that's shot, or these kids that, in my second year, over 26 homicides, and you're just trying to place yourselves in their mind. What is in your mind? Don't you want to live? Well, you got all of that coming in as the mayor, and then you're saying, well, then you got to figure it out. You're the man. You and your administration have to figure it out. You got to do better. And one of the things I learned early on is never be bashful in asking for help, because people will help you if they know that you're willing to take them in. So I've been asking for a lot of help these days, and a lot of people have been very, very helpful. And there's more to celebrate about the great diversity of the city and all of its people, more things to build, more lives to improve. But I'd say that this city is worth loving. It's worth serving. It's hard. It's never easy. But you got to give 150% every day. And so I got to have a good sense of humor when I walk into the office.
I think you're well equipped in that regard.
Leeks.
We extend our thanks to San Francisco Mayor Ed Lee for sharing his aspirations for our beautiful city. We want to also thank KQED's John Boland and our audiences here and on radio, television, and the Internet. I'm your moderator, Kerry Curtis, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.